protecting our air and water from toxic chemicals that could be emitted should we not do this bill. In 2006, the Environmental Protection Agency relaxed the reporting requirements for companies to emit chemicals into the atmosphere from 500 pounds to 2,000 pounds. And many people believed that this was backtracking on an important piece of legislation that we passed federally in response to the toxic release of large amounts of chemicals in Bhopal, India, and in 1986. Minnesota and I believe 13 other states filed suit against the EPA and to roll back the relaxing of the reporting standards. And the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has asked that Minnesota maintain the previous standard for reporting of emissions of chemicals, maintain the previous level at 500 pounds as opposed to 2,000. It seems a reasonable request that allows us to keep the current level of environmental protection we have as opposed to relaxing the level of environmental protection we have, and also allows us to continue to collect the fees that we previously collected for issuing those permits. It's a pretty straightforward request, and I think it would be a wise move for the legislature to do. I'll stand for any questions.
Okay, are there any questions on the bill? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What was the reason for the EPA rule to begin with?
That's simple.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, previous to the EPA rule in 1986 being enacted, there weren't reporting requirements for the release of chemicals into the atmosphere. And as a result, there were instances of those releases, the public around the release being members of the community getting sick, all sorts of other public health ramifications for the release not being reported. This required the businesses or the whoever was emitting chemicals to report that, and so then the EPA could track it and ideally reduce the amount of pollutants that were being emitted. Requiring 500 pounds, they believed, was a kind of a threshold amount to protect the public health from any amount greater than that 500 pounds being emitted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bowles. So this is another mandate, then, we're putting on businesses?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, actually this is maintaining the previous level of requirement. It's not increasing the so-called mandate, but it's maintaining the level of public health and environmental protection we've enjoyed in Minnesota for over 20 years.
And Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Moe. So did any businesses or anybody testify for or against this bill
in the committee?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, there's been no testimony in opposition to this bill so far.
Okay, any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, then all in favor of the motion to pass House File 3685 and re-refer it to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. We now have Representative Moore here.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're very welcome. And this is House File 4100 that was the report from the Transportation Division. Representative Leader, care to move the report?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the Transportation Finance Division report for House File 4100, First Committee Endorsement.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion carried. Representative Leader, here to move the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 4100, First Committee Engrossment, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Morrow, here to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members
of the bill.
This bill concerns funding of the Department of Vehicle Services computer system. I have Ms. McCormick here from DVS who could talk about the need. Members, we funded a pre-design in 2007 of this antiquated computer system. We've heard about it a great deal in the Transportation Finance Committee. The question now is, A, does the state proceed with replacing the computer system, and perhaps more importantly, B, how do we pay for that computer system? But before I turn to that, I'll turn to Ms. McCormick with the Chair's permission to describe the computer system and the needs.
Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And as Representative Morrow explained, our system, current information system, was built in the early 1980s, and it was a system that basically is only able to you are only able to access information by writing a program to access that information. It's a legacy mainframe system. The technology used to program it is not used in developing new systems. It does not allow for us to do any type of communication electronically with other information systems. At the same time, we've also had concerns with trying to maintain its stability, having enough technology specialists that are familiar with COBOL programming, which was what was used when this was developed in the early 1980s. And so we believe that it is time to redesign a system that can communicate electronically with other information systems and to try to be able to ensure the security and maintain data integrity and accuracy of our motor vehicle and driver license records, as well as to integrate that information so that we do have the most up-to-date information. Currently, we have two separate systems, motor vehicle and driver license information systems. And depending on the transaction that's going on with the customer, the driver license information system may not necessarily be as accurate as what's on the motor vehicle system, because on the driver's license, you renew your driver's license every 4 years. With motor vehicle, you are renewing your registration of vehicles on a yearly basis, and so that is another challenge with our current system. We have, as Representative Moreau said, we have we're working on a pre-design plan, and this pre-design plan has looked at various other systems from other motor vehicle systems from other states. We have also talked and looked at what we need to do, and we have looked at a four-year plan where during that 4 years we would design the system in chunks. We wouldn't try to do an all-encompassing change at one time, because as you know and what you can see from the handout that we passed out, we oversee many areas and interact with many stakeholders and serve in many capacities on behalf of the state in collection of taxes and fees for other programs in addition to our own. And so we would do it in chunks. We'd have to keep our current system going while we were developing the new system, and that's where some of the costs come in based on our discussions with other states that have undertaken this kind of a project. So we believe a four-year project with about a little over $12 million a year, around a $48 million project, is what we are hoping that we would be able to undertake if we can secure the funding for this project.
Okay, thank you. Any discussion on the bill? Representative Mahoney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking through the bill briefing and then your information here, I missed the question to the testifier. there is a debacle that happened this year with the unemployment insurance, and I have to be honest, some of your statements were almost a verbatim for from committees in years past, and a commissioner that came in front of us talking about changing the unemployment system, and we had serious problems. So my question is kind of twofold. Did you learn anything from the unemployment computer changeover, and if so, what were they, and how are you going to do it different? So I guess it's three questions.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, I think we did have a debriefing by the Chief Information Officer of the project at the Unemployment System Project in terms of learning, trying to understand what we could gain in terms of not ensuring that we would not make or have similar problems in terms of the project. And one of those lessons learned that I wasn't able to go to that presentation, but I got a briefing of it and had other staff at it at the time. But my understanding is that one of the major things was that it's very important that the project not take too long of a time, because you need to ensure that you have, for one thing, thought through the entire business process, re-engineering first. And I don't know enough about, you know, as that's one of our main goals, is we already are working on business process re-engineering at this time, that we include all the staff that and are making sure we have staff that can devote the time they need to on the project. In other words, they may not be doing their normal jobs during this process if we need them as business experts, because we need to make sure that the business is driving the project and that we're ensuring that we've thought through every exception, as well as the fact that we need to ensure that when in doing it in chunks, that we're sure we have one chunk working before we go to the next chunk in terms of the process. So those are some of the things that we did talk about after that briefing from the committee, but I think we have also tried to include in committees that we have working in our pre-design. We have brought in stakeholders from other agencies. We are working very closely with the Office of Enterprise Technology in every step of the way to ensure that we are getting the support and we're getting outside expertise to look at what we're doing and what we're planning on. We are talking to other states. We're still gathering information. And I think we believe that we are trying to learn from other systems. And I think we have a strong support from the top. And that I didn't hear about being the case in unemployment, but we've heard that from other states. Colorado is an example in a motor vehicle agency where they didn't have as much involvement from the top. We've had the commissioner's office, our CIO, and other stakeholders, upper level leadership at meetings to discuss this and to get their feedback and learn from them. So I do feel that we are trying very hard to not make mistakes that have been made in other projects. We also talked to Wisconsin's technology staff, where they've done the same process in over a 20-year period, and that they said that was a very much of a mistake, that you need to get it done so that you are able to support the technology and you are completing it and not having it go from one technical agency to another.
Senator Mahoney.
Just a quick follow-up then. One of the things in the previous computer switchover that became pretty obvious early on, very obvious as we delved into it, is that they did not have staff ready at the telephones when everything fell apart. And they had to take 2 or 3 or 4 weeks to train these people before they could go onto the phone. Now, your process hasn't started, but this is not really a question, but it's a request, is that you have people pre-trained to go on the phone if everything goes down the drain, so to speak, or the wheels come off. I guess that'd be a more appropriate metaphor in this case. And I certainly hope, because our constituents, and I don't care whether they're either side of the aisle, don't deserve to have those kind of problems as they come down. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Morrow, I'm looking at this and I see that there's no sunset on it, so I'm wondering what the increased fee will be used for once the completion of the technology system is made. I'm wondering if there's a reason why there isn't a sunset on it. To be honest, I'm not big on the bill because I think it should come from a different fund in light of all the increases that we've had this session. But if you could address that issue specifically with the sunset, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pepin, I have talked with DVS about the possibility of a sunset, and I'm open to having a sunset. The reason I didn't put a sunset in the bill as it's written right now is in talking with DVS, I know there was concerns about ongoing maintenance and other care for the computer system once it was built, and not wanting to close the door and having a funding source, to be blunt, to maintain, upgrade the computer system. Ms. McCormick may have more to add to that, but that was my thinking. Again, I'm open to it, but I was seeking more direction from DVS.
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Representatives, what our current budget for operating our system is $1.6 million. In essence, though, we spend $4.9 million in operating the system. What we've had to do is we have a lot of grant opportunities that we've taken advantage of and been able to utilize grant funds to help us with technology projects. We also have had to redirect other efforts in order to pay for that system. Our estimates at this time would be that the ongoing maintenance of the system would be what we think about $7.6 million. It would be $3.8 million just for the technical operation of a new system and approximately $3.8 million for the staffing that would be needed for a system as large as the system that we operate at this particular time. So what we're thinking right now, scoping it out, it'd be about $7.6 million. So it would not be at the same level that the funding that we're requesting now, as well as the fact that we do get $1.6 million now that we earmarked for technology services. So it would probably be an additional $6 million is what our thoughts are in terms of operating the system at this time.
So about half of what you'd need
that's correct.
To install the system. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And so the testifier, can you just state that again, the staffing levels for the existing system versus the new one, how much higher are the staffing costs for the new system?
McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the cost of our operating of the current system right now are $4.9 million, and our current budget right now for that is $1.6 million. So we redirect other funds to be able to pay for our current operation of our system. What we are saying is that the new system, we believe it would cost $3.8 million to operate the system itself, and then in addition, $3.8 million for staffing, technical staffing for the system. So a total of $7.6 million, which would be $6 million above and beyond what our technical budget is at this current time.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Grapple.
Mr. Chairman, and to the testifier, and maybe it's not a fair question to ask, but usually when system upgrades take place, we see efficiencies, lower total cost of ownership. I work in the technology sector outside of here, and normally we don't see maintenance costs increase by 40%. And maybe, again, it's not a fair question for you, but do you know what makes this project so special that the total cost of ownership would actually rise?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that some of the reasons are with our system, the amount of data security that's needed for the 5 million driving records that we have and over 6.5 million vehicle records that we have, and the fact that we are talking about all private data, and the fact that we are also required under state and federal law to share this data with a number of state agencies as well as with a number of federal agencies, make it a fairly complicated process, in addition to the fact that we collect over $1.1 billion on an annual basis on behalf of the state. And a lot of the money that we collect, as you know, does not stay with CVS. We're collecting it on behalf of the state, and it's tax revenue. And so it's a fairly complicated system. And while we've been able to get by, we have not been able to get by easily. And as I said before, ensure that we completed the requirements that were needed to secure our tab renewal online site, that alone cost us over $1.6 million to make the security changes for that. I think where you would see more efficiency is not on the technical side, but more on the business side, in the sense of hopefully staff not having to enter the information two or three times in order to produce a driver's license or a title, and to be able to electronically communicate so that we're not having to do things manually like we do right now, where we manually have to take messages from other states and update driver's records because we're not able to electronically message the information. A state can send us a message, but we have to manually update the driver record of a violation from another state because we don't have the capability to electronically have that message sent and put onto a driving record, as most other states are able to do at this time.
Mr. Chairman, and to the testifier, when a person renews their tab fees online, right now they pay a surcharge. Does that stay with DVS or does it go elsewhere?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the fee that you pay for that service goes to for the financial accounting that's involved and to the financial institution that maintains the secure data, because all that data is on the bank side. It's not held with us, all the financial data. And so we have to pay a cost to the financial institution for them to do that part of the process. That's what you're paying for, and the credit card costs when you do it online.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman and Representative, Representative Morrow, what will this raise annually?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, my understanding is that this will raise approximately the $12.25 million to pay for the computer system.
And members, we do have the fiscal note in the packets.
I do not have a copy of the fiscal note.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman, Representative Morrow, what is the total cost of the project then over 4 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, my understanding is the cost is estimated to be between $48 and $50 million.
And Mr. Chairman, my final question: the license tab increase that we passed earlier this year—is it correct that the 10-year license tab increase raised about $1.7 billion? Is that number right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, I couldn't tell you. I would accept that if you told me that, or Ms. McCormick knew.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have Representative Hilty?
Chair, Mr. McCormick answered my question already.
Okay, and Representative House.
I'm going to pass.
Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, actually for Ms. McCormick, you talked about updating the technology, so when something comes in from another state, you're going to be able to have it entered faster, where now you have to physically type it in. Are you also then going to have it so you can resolve the issue of dispute, if there's a dispute immediately as well, so Representative Garofalo's client or our constituent who might be traveling somewhere and for whatever reason has pulled over and speeding a little bit, and all of a sudden the trooper says we've got this information from the state of California or Wisconsin or Illinois that says something's been unresolved there, etc., etc. And he says, what are you talking about? Or, gosh, I forgot about that, or whatever. But the reason I'm asking you this is because I periodically have these issues come up, and the underlying theme is if it's after business hours, and even if it's during business hours, there's no way for the driver to resolve this issue. If it's a weekend, if it's an evening, 6 p.m. supper time. And so I'm just wanting assurance that there's going to be a two-way street here, and if there's information electronically put in, there's a way to dispute it and not have your car impounded or something, or your driver's license revoked, and you have to call a friend to pick you up. Is that going to be part of the updated system?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Westrom, I think there's a couple different ways to answer that question. If we're talking about will this ensure that the information is more accurate, that is our goal, because every time you re-enter information, there's more of a chance that there could be an error made by the person typing it in from another person's piece of paper that you're getting, or an application form or whatever, or court document. But in terms of if there's a violation in another state and that message would be sent electronically by that state to our system and would be entered on the record, in terms of being able to resolve that issue with the driver that may be a Minnesota driver, the problem is always going to be that driver has to be involved in notifying the state that there's an error in the record or whatever it might be, because of the fact that all driver and motor vehicle agencies are working with private data, and we are not allowed to change that data without that driver's permission. So in terms of assisting us to get better and more accurate information, it will help. But in terms of, and we do try working very hard to resolve things on behalf of our constituents, but we would, without having a 24/7 shop, I don't think that we would be able to assist drivers on the spot. I think we are trying very hard to get more accurate information and trying to notify drivers if there's problems, and we get a better, we are working very hard at electronically getting information from the problem driver pointer system right now about violations in other states, but it's still on the onus of that driver to get those violations from another state taken care of so that we can allow them to drive within our state.
Mr. Chair, Ms. McCormick, I mean, that raises some concern to me. We go down this electronic path. It's going to get so efficient at putting Representative Rukavina's constituents in jail. And, you know, at some point, where do we lose a little common sense? It might have been 10 years ago. It might have been an issue. I'll give you one scenario. A speeding ticket, constituent of mine, he was a truck driver. He since had left the trucking industry, went into a job in the Twin Cities here, had family out in my area, and they called me. They had gotten a speeding ticket, and there was a parking ticket in Illinois or Wisconsin that was unresolved from 7-8 years ago, thought the trucking company had resolved it, and it happened on a weekend. And now all this information stuck in the system, and he's pulled over and loses his ability to drive right off the bat, and has no way to resolve this parking ticket, $50, $100, nothing significant. And we're sticking all this in the system, and now we're going to do it without even having somebody look at it. I understand your system, your statement that, you know, when you don't have a person feeding it in, they might not type it wrong. But what happens when somebody puts it in wrong in the first place? Nobody's checking it along the way either, so I think it goes a little both ways. But I think if we aren't going to resolve that issue, at some point we shouldn't be sticking all this information out there. If there's not a way for the driver to resolve it when they're pulled over or when they're sent a notice or have an issue occur in the evenings or weekends. And so, you know, this sounds great and glorious, but I receive the calls, and they're usually Friday nights or Saturdays when I get them, because the people that are good, hardworking Minnesotans, but the long arm of the law is going to wrap them up. And another case, I know of one person, they had their car impounded. They had to call their relatives. They were coming home on a Friday night from the Twin Cities, and some outstanding issues, nothing significant, speeding ticket or something, and they had their car impounded, and they couldn't resolve it till Monday. And they had to have their relatives drive them around and bring them back home for the weekend. I mean, this stuff is getting ridiculous, and if you're not going to pursue getting the issues resolved fast, but you want to get it put on electronically fast, I think you need to re-examine the whole picture before we just add one part of efficiency and let the voters or the residents live with it, because government doesn't want to update its customer service process. So just a concern you can take back if this passes or not. If we're going to put more money into something, we certainly should be able to offer better customer service to the driving public.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, will these fees and stuff here get rid of jobs with the new technology coming on board, or are we looking at the efficiency of reducing the jobs needed to complete your process?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, at this particular time, I would not say that that's the goal of a new system. I think that we are right in the current process of doing a workforce plan. We expect over 20% of our current staff to be retiring within the next 5 years. We have very long-term staff. The average length of service is over 20 years within our division. And so it's very important, and we're doing the re-engineering process along with our workforce plan to ensure that we are documenting and reviewing all business process of the staff so that we are able to see where there may be efficiencies. But I think we're talking about a changing workforce in terms of we are still very much production-oriented at this current time, because as you can see, if you look at our numbers, we're issuing over 1.4 million titles a year. We are issuing over 1.6 million driver's licenses a year. We're doing enormous amounts of road tests and knowledge tests on a yearly basis, and we operate 95 exam stations throughout the state. And so we take in over 1 million phone calls a year and emails that we address. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done. But I think we are trying very hard to ensure that we have staff that are learning the new technology, and that we are looking at where we can increase customer service and building on what Representative Westrom talked about, we have worked very hard in the last 2 years to try to improve our customer service. We are requiring all staff to take, we have a 10-module training for providing excellent customer service, and we have staff that are and supervisors that are required to take that training. And so we are trying very hard to ensure that we really are completing our mission, which is to provide fair, accurate, secure, and timely service.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, you mentioned on your sheet that's been handed out, Representative Morrill, that you sent out here, and it talks about different people in the process, especially from the local county area, the Deputy Registrar's Office. Is there money that's from this, these fees that are coming in that are going to be down to help support the Deputy Registrar's Office in processing these titles and registrations, or are they kind of on their own?
McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, obviously a new system and is very important to our driver 125 driver license agents and our 173 deputy registrars, because they are obviously the face to the public, especially in terms of motor vehicle transactions. And so it is very important for us to have a system that is working, that's secure, that they can count on, that isn't going to go down when they have a line of customers in front of them. We are not, at this particular time, this is not part of that project. They are understanding of that fact that right now we are concentrating on ensuring that we have an up-to-date system that can provide the services that we need to for our customers, and they are supportive of this project.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Anderson.
Representative Morrill, where's the governor on your bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, my understanding is that the governor agreed that the computer system needs to be replaced. But the way the governor proposed to fund it was to take the $12 million or so a year out of the trunk highway fund, the road and bridge money. When I've talked to the, for example, the auto dealers who support a new computer system because of the delays in processing titles, you may have received a letter from the deputy registrars in your area also supporting the project for the reasons that Ms. McCormick mentioned. I understand that maybe Ms. McCormick received a letter from police chiefs and sheriffs across the state also supporting the system because it would facilitate law enforcement, traffic stops, checking records and the like. So, Representative Anderson, the difference here lies in, I think, primarily how one funds the system. I think the need is accepted, and the question is, do we take road and bridge money, or do we use a source that is rationally related to the service being provided, the titles and the licenses?
Okay, Representative Hausman.
That was my question.
Okay, and Representative Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern also is around the whole computer system, like the unemployment insurance, the child care system also got a new computer that was going to solve all the world's problems and went on and on and on with issues. So that's one concern. My second is just a question concerning security. There were reports, I'm sure you saw them, in the news about employees hacking into the licenses at home and getting people's private information. Is this new system, I guess it wasn't even hacking, they had access to it through their passwords, and they could take the same passwords at home and access the system. Is there going to be something to that is more secure in this new system?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that we are trying very hard to address that at the current time. We're not waiting for a new system. We've been very, before that even happened, we had offered training to our, we'd required training of our staff, and they're required to sign an agreement on a yearly basis that talks about the fact that they will implement our data practices, policies, and if they do not, that they would, discipline would follow up to and including termination. And that is required of every staff person, including myself, on a yearly basis. I think that we certainly are hopeful that this would bring a new level of security. We are able to audit, but I think we're looking at being able to do, and we do more, as I think Commissioner Campion stated in his press conference, that we are doing routine audits to verify that our staff are not accessing data outside of work, or and also not data that they're not allowed to access because it isn't part of their particular job responsibilities. We've been very serious with our staff and our supervisors in implementing those policies, but I do think that we're looking for more a higher level of security, and that's one of the center points of the new system plan at this time because of the fact we have so much private data and the need to keep it secure.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up. Is there a way that you could have a system where they can't access it from home but only at work? I mean, I'm sure you've thought of all these things, but that seemed to be the issue.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we have stopped allowing access of the system at all except for law enforcement who need it 24/7, and they have a separate website. The website that we're using, we are only allowing it to be even available at this time just until the deputy registrar offices close and the dealer offices close, because they, as our agents, need to have the access to help their customers. And we are not allowing access. We do not have the system up and running on weekends when the offices aren't open, unless there are some special groups that have the access that are provided to, but it's done on a case-by-case basis. So we have taken those steps.
Thank you.
Representative
Stevenson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. McCormick, a couple of years ago, I carried a bill that allowed people to go directly to the dealer, pick up their plates for an extra $20 on there. That also cut out the deputy registrar out of the picture, but we kept the fee. I thought it did, didn't
it? Mr. Chair and Representative Stevenson, the deputies are part of that process.
Mr.
Chair.
And my understanding was it was in one of these processes that we were bypassing the deputy registrar. Is that not the case any longer?
Mr. Chair and Representative Severson, the TV, what's called our electronic title and verification registration system, does require that the dealers still need to bring the paperwork into the deputies and process it through the deputies. And you may be talking about expedited services, which is a system that still does allow you to bring the work into the deputy, and then they get part of the fee for processing it quickly while the customer is right at the counter, so that they don't have to wait for getting the process through our regular normal process, and they pay an extra fee. And there were some salvage vehicles that we are only allowing our staff to do versus having them done with the deputies. So I'm thinking that may be what you're thinking of.
Okay. And a little bit to that point, I think one of the issues that we're always striving to do in the legislature here is create efficiencies, which I think is what this bill drives at, creating efficiencies through a computerized system. But I'm just curious as to whether DVS has got a long-term plan here in terms of once this is implemented, how this is automated so it precludes having to have the number of people in the long term that we currently have. Because just like when we go online to renew our tags now, we go online, put the information in, get the tags back in the mail in about 2 weeks, and I'm not sure where the deputy registrar would fall into that one, but I know there's a fee on that one as well.
Mr. Chair and Representative Severson, at the current time, you know, DVS's goal has been to offer customers options. So we have a self-service option for tab renewals, which is online. Only about 5% of our customers do their tabs online.
That's amazing.
About 20% of 20 to 25% do them through the mail, and the rest go in. Of at least over 70% of our customers go into deputy registrars to do their tab renewals.
Okay.
And so we are offering all those options. We have no plans to change offering those options at this current time. Our customers apparently seem to prefer to go into the deputy registrar's and do their tab renewals at the deputy registrar's office. Obviously, with driver's licenses, we have to see the person and have the person there, because that's part of our process. It's part of our authentication to ensure that the person is who they say they are, and so that process wouldn't be changing. And we are trying to offer different options for titles so that people can get those as quickly as they can. And right now we have other than through this electronic verification or title registration process, we are now able to do them much more quickly in terms of entering the information through that process, but we've just started it. It's been very difficult for us to ramp that project up because of the antiquated information system that we have. And so we're just starting to really roll it out across the state at this time.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, we'll take the committee's time here, but I would think that at 5% going online, that amazes me, because we were just talking about the number of people that now file their income tax over the net. And maybe there should be an incentive program that we hit here that basically creates some incentives or some savings to actually do it online by going into the deputy registrar and waiting at the notorious DMV line. So just a comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for Ms. McCormick, this basically kind of follows up on some of the questions that Representative Severson had. I was just wondering, is there currently an extra fee for transactions that are made online? I didn't hear if you had mentioned that before. You may have. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, there is a online fee, and I don't remember exactly what it is off the top of my head, but it basically just pays for the cost for doing the business through the financial institution so that they can verify the financial information, and it's kept secure by the financial institution.
Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and committee members, we've had this bill in the policy committee and the finance committee, and I think we've reviewed it pretty much thoroughly, and I'd like to move to House File 4100, first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and be referred to Committee on Taxes.
Representative Leader renews his motion. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Chair, thank you, Mr.
You're welcome. The next bill is House File 3380 by Representative Lieberly. And Representative Huntley, here to make a couple of motions.
Mr. Chair, I would move the Health and Human Services Finance Division report for House File 3380, first committee engrossment.
The motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, and all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Representative
Hunley? Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would move House File 3380, first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Leibling is here to description of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll try to be quick. First of all, I want you to know that this bill is in finance only because there was an amendment on it which gave it a fiscal note, but that amendment has been taken off. So the bill that you have before you has no state fiscal note at all. What this is, many of you are probably familiar with county-based purchasing. This is a year, members, in which obviously we're wrestling with a lot of health care reform issues. And one of the big issues that we're trying to do in health care reform is trying to have better coordination of care and looking at the potential that holds to control costs. But I think it's very important that we not only consider one kind of health care reform, and county-based purchasing really represents some real potential in the area of controlling costs.
We know that our counties are really struggling right now. They have a lot of responsibilities. The funding streams have been cut. We know that the federal government has cut their funding for managed care and or case management, excuse me. And what this does is also have the possibility of helping counties be able to be innovators and figure out ways to possibly control costs into the future. So I think that this has potential as we go forward to actually have positive fiscal results for the state. County-based purchasing is something that 25 counties already have. What my bill does is essentially what we're trying to do is have what amounts to a county-based purchasing pilot program in 5 counties in the southeast corner of the state. And the reason that it's a pilot, even though 25 other counties are doing this, is that Olmsted would be the first metro county to be involved in this and would be in a joint powers agreement with 4 rural counties. So this is a kind of a new model. All of the other counties, and it's kind of a federal creature of federal law that the metro counties have to have competition, but rural counties do not. So all of the counties that have existing county-based purchasing have no competition. They are single-plan counties. So the county-based purchasing plan is the only one. In this model called the Steadfast Plan that we're proposing, that would not be the case. And that is why we have in this bill what we call the default language. So really the essence of this bill is the default language that we're asking for. And what that means is simply that when a new person is enrolled when they enter into our public programs and they need to choose a plan, a certain number of people just simply don't choose. In other words, they're given the materials for the various options that are available. Some don't choose. What we're asking for is to have those who do not choose a plan assigned to the county plan. The reason that we need this is to simply to start off being able to have our economics work to get the plan off the ground. And the difference here, I'm told, would be that we would be able to be financially viable in 3 years instead of 5. And so that's why we have the bill, and in a nutshell, why we're asking for this language. County-based purchasing is already something that's happening in the state, as I've explained. It's not a matter of starting a whole new model, but it is a matter of authorizing this default procedure so that we can start this new way of doing county-based purchasing in the southeast corner of the state. And I have some folks with me who can answer questions who are much more knowledgeable than I am if members have questions.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, we'll see if there are some, and I think there may be at least one.
Mr. Chair, if there's no fiscal note, and Representative Huntley's committee has heard the bill, couldn't we just renew the motion and move forward here without taking testimony? I assume that testimony was given in Representative Huntley's committee.
I don't think, we don't generally take testimony. We have people available to answer questions, and that was what Representative Wiegelin pointed out. But as she pointed out with her initial comments, the reason it was originally here is a cost, and that has been removed. And
Mr. Chair, I understand that, but if we're dealing with the policy, and the policy was dealt with in Representative Huntley's committee, could we not move forward?
I was about to take a vote until I recognized Representative.
Then I would renew the. I would ask we renew the motion and move forward,
or ask if there was any further discussion before we took the vote. Any further discussion? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Labling. I have some very strong feelings about this, about the default enrollment process, and. I read the portion of the legislative auditor's report that came out in February 2008 about county-based purchasing programs, and it was very, I would say it leaned toward the negative, but basically the part that stuck out for me was the part that talked about how we really need more time to see the success of the county-based purchasing pool, so I'm a little hesitant to want to move forward on it, and I'm also concerned about the article that was just passed out about the bailout. So when you talked about controlling costs, I'm wondering if you, if members had a chance to read this, and if you had a comment on that. And then my question to you would be, I believe that from what I've been contacted with, I believe there are several groups that are opposed to this, And I'm wondering if DHS has taken a position on the enrollment, the auto-enroll process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pepin, well, first of all, answering your question about this article that was handed out, I first want to point out that although Hennepin County runs an HMO, that this is, in fact, not a county-based purchasing plan. It really is much more like just a regular commercial plan. It's not single source. Which all of the other county-based purchasing plans existing already are. Also, I do want to point out that even in this article, and I don't know too much about this county's plan, but they are talking about having their first loss in 25 years of operation. I'd say that's not too bad. So I don't think you can really draw very much from this article. They also talk about the reason being an antiquated computer system and having lost some of their key people recently and things like that. So I don't really think that you can draw much from this. It's also important to see that according to there have been a lot of losses among a lot of plans. The commercial plans have lost, I have numbers here in 2006, I think it is here, the commercial plans lost a total of $86.6 million for the industry. And in 2007, they lost $71 million. So from what I've been told, the only plan in the entire state that actually made money last year was Prime West, which was a county-based purchasing plan. So it seems to be kind of a difficult time for health plans, but I certainly don't think that this is anything that's inherent in county-based purchasing at all. And also, another thing about county-based purchasing, which I think it does say in the auditor's report, is that it really has the potential to improve care. So you have to look at costs, but you also have to look at outcomes for people, and that's a really important one to look at as well. In terms of the Department of Health having a position, I don't know if they have an official position on the default language. I think you'd have to really ask them. I don't remember that they were in the previous committee. I don't remember them being overwhelmingly in favor of it, but I don't really recall if they had a position against it.
Thanks, and perhaps it would be good to have them up to talk about it if it were available. But I guess a follow-up question would be, I'm wondering, so Steadfast, I don't know much about Steadfast, but I'm wondering what qualifies Steadfast to be the default plan for all these families that would be automatically enrolled in this if they didn't make a choice. I'm just wondering what the merits are, what proof we have that Steadfast is going to be able to do that. And then as a follow-up to that, I would like to hear DHS's position if they have concerns about this, because we're not going to get a chance to ask these questions of DHS once it hits the floor.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, Representative Pepin, I don't know what you mean by what qualifies them. I mean, certainly, first of all, we have to recognize these are public programs. These are public dollars. So, I guess the question would be, do we owe something to the private plans that we would not do this? I mean, I guess I would flip the question around, because these are our dollars for our clients, and these are our counties. They're a creature of state government. So I would first answer it that way. Secondly, when you look at the numbers of what we're talking about here, we're not talking about that big of a thing in terms of the numbers and what the private plans would be losing if we did this. And for example, I mean, the number of people that UCARE has enrolled, and this is as of 2006, and we're talking all enrollees, I have the numbers are about 127,000. For the Blues, again in 2006, it's 259,000 people. For county-based purchasing, we're talking about, in these five counties, there are a total of 18,000 people on our public program. So we're talking about a drop in the bucket here. And we're talking about if you have about 3,000 new enrollees, so we're talking about 3,000 new people coming in, if a third of them do not make a choice, that's about what it is. So you've got about 1,000 people that, instead of being divided a third, a third, a third, would all go to the Steadfast plan. So we're talking about each of these plans losing about 350 enrollees in a year. When you hold that up against the number of people that they represent all over the state, I mean, it's just, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's teeny, 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 tiny. And for Steadfast and getting it off the ground and allowing us to have this kind of pilot and looking at the potential really great benefits of it, I think it's a small risk to take.
Can we get DHS and
she's standing there ready to come forward. She would just identify herself for the record. And the question, I think, is what is your position?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Karen Peet. I'm with the Department of Human Services. Our position is that we would need to take this request, since it is for a portion of the state, to CMS for approval. What CMS requires of the department is that we have a reasonable and fair method of assigning people who don't make a choice. And the method that we use at this time is actually a sequential method. So the first person who comes forward today is assigned to Plan A, the second person is assigned to Plan B, and so on. We would be required to demonstrate to CMS that this is a reasonable means of assigning people. So the other requirement that we do also have in federal regulation is that if people have a pre-existing relationship and they lose eligibility, that they would be within 90 days, I believe, it's either 60 or 90, and I apologize, I didn't look it up before I came over today, they would be reassigned to their previous plan. So primarily what we're talking about here is for people who would be newly enrolled or who would be changing perhaps from a plan that is no longer available, who did not make a choice. And by having the default assignment, it is likely that there would be some benefit to Steadfast Health Plan. The main area of concern that I'd like to highlight would be for seniors and for people who are dually eligible for Medicare and Medicaid. We're currently dealing with a moratorium from Medicare on new development of special needs plans. And for our seniors, most of whom are dually eligible for Medicare and Medicaid, they get the bulk of their physician and hospital services paid for by Medicare and their prescription drugs, and then DHS pays the coinsurance and for any Medicaid services that would not be covered by Medicare. For people who are seniors who would be assigned to Steadfast Health Plan in these counties that have been identified, that means that they would not have access to the integrated product that DHS otherwise offers. And the reason for that, as I say, is that there's a moratorium from the federal government at least through 2009 on expansion of those plans. If the federal government opens that up and we have contracts with Steadfast would be eligible to apply to become a plan. The concern from the point of view of seniors is that they would then have two or three different cards that they would have to use to access their health care services, and that the service delivery system is fragmented for them.
Representative Huntley.
Well, just very briefly, so people know what they're voting on. It's not just the Metropolitan Health Plan that lost $6 million, but the South Country community-based, county-based purchasing lost $9 million last year, which taxpayers are going to have to pay. We don't have to pay for the losses that private health plans have. Secondly, the legislative auditor said that the county-based purchasing has higher administrative costs than the private plans. It is said that they have lower quality than the private plans. And the intent of this was to have them to be able to compete. They're not getting sole source, so they're supposed to compete with the other health plans in this district. And if they get the default thing, then they will have an unfair advantage over the health plans that are there. And I just want to talk about one health plan for a second. UCARE has about 38% of the Olmsted County public enrollees, and it has about 25% of the enrollees in the other counties in this group. And if you want to know what UCARE is, it was started, I believe, in the 80s by university faculty, med school faculty, and it treats only public clients. Its sole mission is to treat people on MA, GAMC, Minnesota Care, or Medicare. And they have high quality and lower administrative costs than the county-based purchasing. And as I said, this bill will give the counties an unfair advantage over groups like UCARE.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the Health and Human Services, well, HHS, is there gone? Oh, there they are. Okay. I didn't get your name.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson, my name is Karen Peed with the Department of Human Services.
Yeah. If I was living in these counties that we're talking about, and I have a daughter that has special needs, and she's on medical assistance and stuff like that, will I still get the same kind of care under this kind of a purchasing plan, or that's there, or what's your take on that for my daughter that would be have special needs?
If Mr. Representative Anderson, if your daughter who has special needs also qualifies as a person with disabilities, she would not be she would not be required to join a plan like this. Primarily, we're talking about families and children, pregnant women, people who are eligible for health care through the state of Minnesota who do not have a disability, except for those people who may have a disability, but they're also over the age of 65 and qualify for medical assistance because they are seniors. So primarily the people that would be served under a county-based purchasing plan would be families and children and people who are seniors, 65 and older. Persons who have a disability are not required to join a plan and would be able to volunteer. Steadfast does not have a contract with us for special needs basic care at this time.
Representative Anderson, did you have a
call? She looks like she wants to respond to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this was a good point at which to mention that if you look at the bill at 3.6, it says the commissioner shall assign an eligible individual. So I just wanted to point out that what Ms. Peed was talking about before about the federal moratorium and people who wouldn't be able to get all the services and stuff, those people are not eligible, and as I read the bill, wouldn't be assigned to this at all. So that's a completely separate issue.
Mr. Chair, I just would like to clarify that if for people who are seniors, they are Medicare eligible, or many of them are Medicare and Medicaid eligible. So those were the people that I expressed concern for who might have trouble getting an integrated product. They would still have access to their services. They would just have to negotiate several systems in order to get their health care paid for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Attorney Liebling, is this being used anyplace else in the nation? Are we kind of a guinea pig?
I think you've addressed that at the beginning. But
yeah, I think so, Mr. Chair. I don't know about the rest of the nation, Representative Anderson, to be perfectly frank, but it certainly is being done in the rest of the state. And, you know, although there, again, you know, Representative Huntley's raising some issues about losing money and so on, but all the plans have been losing money except Prime West, which is a large county-based purchasing. So, I mean, there are, you know, let's face it, there are a lot of issues that just being a certain kind of entity doesn't answer all the questions. You know, there are management issues, there are issues of getting started. I mean, I think Steadfast is in a great position to draw from the lessons that have been already learned in the other plans. So, you know, if we're saying, do we have a good chance of success? I'd say we have a very good chance of success, not to mention that Olmsted County is a, you know, I mean, I don't want to be too, you know, bragging about it here, but Olmsted County is a very well-managed county, and Olmsted County is really gearing up to do this. So I think that this has an excellent chance of being very successfully carried out and to be a good model for the rest of the state.
When I was referencing the beginning, I thought you indicated this was to be a pilot because
yes.
of its competitive mm-hmm. component, if I understood it, if that's correct.
Right.
Following up Representative Anderson's question as to whether it's been done anywhere else before, but you indicated at least in Minnesota this is a pilot, I think.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, sorry if I confused people. The pilot aspect of this is the Metro County with the competition. So people will have a choice of plans. The choice is there. If your daughter, say, was eligible for this and came in and she could choose which one of these plans she wanted, the only thing we're getting at is people who don't choose for whatever reason. And I have to say that, you know, if we look at who's likely to not make a choice, the people who are likely to not choose, in fact, could possibly be the most difficult clients. So, you know, that might actually be the more challenging patients for the county-based plan, but that is the way they want to do it.
Representative Hausman?
I just want to revisit Representative Blasey's point earlier. I'm still a little confused because I thought I heard Representative Humphrey making arguments against the bill, but I thought it had already been through that committee, and it was here because it at one point had fiscal impact, but now does not. And so I'm a little confused about the route of the bill, but to the department, I think to look at one plan in the context of this entire country and find fault with one, when I think we would be hard pressed, the department and the nation, to point to anything that's working right now. I think if there's one thing that's clear, everybody knows everything's broken. There is no system. Who is holding down costs? Who is assuring good outcomes? Nobody. And so why we at this point would presume to have enough knowledge to argue that a group of counties that is at the home of Mayo Clinic doesn't have enough knowledge to be allowed a pilot project, I think is just amazing to me. The context of the whole healthcare discussion is what I find perplexing in our aspect because it's just small.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say two of these counties are counties I represent, Maurer and Fillmore counties, and they are actually asking for help. They would like to be able to have that opportunity, and I appreciate Representative Hausman's comments because many other counties have entered into county-based purchasing for health services, and they're in the southeastern Minnesota area. We don't always tie ourselves to Olmsted County. Sometimes we see ourselves in competition with Olmsted County, frankly. But in this case, we're seeing this as a good opportunity. When we're smaller counties, we're saying, you know, we'd like to be able to have the opportunity to try county-based purchasing when it comes to health services. I think they're going to be making good decisions based on everything that they see before them. They're just asking for the opportunity to make this decision, to be able to be, we hear local control a lot. This is the opportunity to have some local control and to do what they think is going to be best for the citizens that they have within their communities. And I just would ask for your support through the Finance Committee. I think it has been through other health services committees here, and I just think that we need to move ahead, and I would just ask for your support.
Representative Lieberman, just a quick question. You emphasized that this was unique because Olmsted County is an urban mm-hmm. county, and I assume Winona is an urban county. Maurer, Fillmore, and Houston are rural, but as long as they are a part of a coalition that at least one or two of the counties would be urban and they're eligible, that's the way it works. You talked about a requirement, a federal requirement, that if you were an urban county, you had to have competition, is what I understood.
Right.
So how do basically rural counties come into the equation here?
Right. Well, Mr. Chair, as I understand it, The metropolitan counties would have to have competition. The rural counties would not. But there is, the plans already are operating in these rural counties that want to be part of this system. So we had single plan language in the bill before to have those counties be able to just have no competition from other plans in those rural counties, but that was very controversial, so we took that language out. So we're not asking to do that, even though under federal law those counties could do that. So all we're asking instead is to have this default language so that we have the possibility of getting this off the ground.
Correctly, and they're not prohibited then under this situation as long as they're part of a, it looks to me like a couple of counties that are metropolitan or urban or however you describe them.
Right. It's, to my knowledge, they would not be prohibited, we're talking about by federal law, they would not be prohibited from having a single plan in those rural counties.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor of the motion by Representative Huntley that House File 3380, the first committee engrossed, would be recommended to pass and place in the general register.
Aye.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion carried. Next meeting is Friday morning at 8 a.m. and we have several bills on the agenda, at least 5 or 6, maybe more. So with that, being adjourned.